Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And we are taking calls from listeners who have questions about the Bible or about Christianity or about your own spiritual walk, even your own spiritual journey. Even if you're not a Christian, be glad to talk to you today. And if you are a person who has a different viewpoint than the host and would like to represent that viewpoint here, we are open to hearing all sides of issues. So you can give me a call here at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and we'll be glad to talk to you. In just a moment, we're going to talk to Adam from Dallas, Texas, but I need to make an announcement or two here. Some of you know that I teach a couple of weekly Bible studies here in the Central California, Central Coast of California area. I teach a Monday night study in Salinas, and I teach a Tuesday night study in Santa Cruz. Both of these are home studies. Just for the next 8 weeks, I've taken on a third weekly commitment here. I'll be teaching on Wednesday nights, that's tonight, at Twin Lakes Church, where on Wednesdays they have a variety of classes by a variety of teachers on different subjects. And once in a while, they'll invite me to teach a series, and I'm going to be doing so beginning tonight. And that will be every Wednesday in February and March. Okay, so from the first Wednesday in February, which is today, to the last Wednesday in March, 8 weeks, we'll be having this series. The general topic is, I think it's being called Following Jesus. To me, it's a study in discipleship, not just an academic study in discipleship. It's going to be a searching study where presumably the people in the class will find out if they are disciples and how to be disciples and what it means to be a disciple. So it's not just an academic study in discipleship. It's actually a course of sorts in discipleship. So that's open to anybody. You don't have to be a member of Twin Lakes Church to come there. This is open to the public. It's at 6:30 tonight and every Wednesday night for the next 8 weeks. 6:30 at Twin Lakes Church. If you don't know where Twin Lakes Church is, go to tlc.org and you can get the information you need about that. It's in Aptos, and it's the largest church in Santa Cruz County, so it's pretty well known, its location. It's over by Cabrillo College. Anyway, it's got a fairly large campus itself. The classes are being held in Munsky Hall, which is kind of one of their big buildings there, and it's got a lot of classrooms in it. So I'll be in one of them. If you come there at 6:30, you can sit in on the class. If you come at 5:30, they serve a meal, which you can buy. The meal is inexpensive, probably $2 or $3, I forget. And it's a full meal for those of you who don't want to go to the trouble of fixing and eating a meal at home and then trying to get to the church by 6:30. You can get there at 5:30 if you want to and eat there. There's also childcare there. So really all your excuses for not coming are taken care of. You can eat there. They've got free childcare, and the class is rather early. It ends at 7:45, so you can even get home early. That's tonight at 6:30. 6:30 to 7:45 is the class, an hour earlier if you want to get there to eat. Tonight and every Wednesday night for the next 8 weeks, teaching on the subject of discipleship, yours truly, at Twin Lakes Church in Aptos. Now, the other announcement, and this is very hopefully going to be brief, is that I mentioned some weeks ago that I will be, Lord willing, running another school, another Great Commission school. It will not be a straight 9-month school as before. It's going to take 2 years with substantial breaks. So it's going to be inconvenient for most people who might want to take the whole school, especially since each module is going to be taught in different locations. Our first module will be in a YWAM base in Seattle, Washington, and that'll be this summer. It's going to be a 10-week module, starting I think June 13th and going for 10 weeks into August. I will be teaching through the Pentateuch, the Gospel of Mark, and the Book of Job, at least in that module. There will be, Lord willing, 4 modules following in different locations and at large intervals, because since I'm doing all the teaching this time, I didn't do that in the Great Commission School before. I did at least half, but not all. But I'm going to be doing all the teaching, so that I don't get burned out, we're going to take at least 6 weeks between modules so I can travel and teach and do other things. Now, this is not going to interfere with the radio programs. I can still do the radio programs while running the school. In fact, I started this radio program while running a similar school in Oregon. And so that's not going to affect our listeners, except those that might want to come to the school. Room and board is all that you'll be paying for if you come to this school. It's a 10-week commitment. It's an immersion course. It's obviously 2.5 months, but the total cost I've just received from YWAM, what they're going to charge me per student, is going to be for housing and food. They're charging $20 a day, so that comes to about $1,500 for the 10 weeks. And for the classes, we charge nothing. So the total cost of the schooling for 2.5 months, including your housing and food, $1,500. Good luck trying to live anywhere else for that price. And this, you get an education in the deal. We're only going to accept, at the most, 12 students. We're not looking for a big class. We're looking for a small group. And YWAM will be having on their facilities another course being conducted, so they don't have infinite room to rent to us. So we're going to keep the school small, about 12 students. And I will have information on the website about that before long. I'm just giving you advance notice because I found out yesterday. I've been waiting to find out what they are going to charge so that I could pass that on to people interested in the course. $20 a day is pretty good for room and board, and that's the total cost of going to the school since we won't be paying any teachers, including myself. All right, so those announcements are behind us. We have Adam in Dallas, Texas in front of us, and I have some open lines also if you want to get in line. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Adam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah.
I have a question about a position that probably I don't think you hold, but maybe some of your listeners do, so they may want to chime in on it as well. And that is on the subject of evolution versus creation. And I guess just putting the scientific evidence aside, I don't find the scientific evidence for evolution very compelling myself, but just putting that aside, the question is more of why would or how do evolutionary Christians hold to that position and not feel that they're doing violence to the Genesis account when you have things like when you try to take it figuratively, you have, you know, millions of years for each day. You have the order of the animals being created in the exact opposite order that evolutionary teaches. They're in the wrong order. You'd have millions of years of death when, before Adam's sin. And you have, you know, some very difficult things to overcome. It seems like it would do violence to what the passage itself is teaching.
Yeah. Well, I myself, like you, I don't find the evidence, the scientific evidence for evolution, very compelling myself. Of course, if we mean macroevolution, if we mean trans-species evolution, yeah, I don't see any evidence for that. But I do, of course, everybody knows there is microevolution. Everybody knows there's variation within the species. That's not what people are talking about when they talk about the theory of evolution. And so, for the general theory of evolution, I don't believe there's any compelling evidence. But as far as biblically, how Christians, justify being evolutionists, of course, they would be theistic evolutionists. They would believe that God is the one who's causing evolution, but they have to, of course, wrestle with the issue of Genesis 1, because you cannot in any sense take Genesis 1 literally and also believe in evolution. For one thing, the order of appearance of creatures is the wrong order, as you have pointed out. I mean, all the plants appear before any animals do. Evolutionists certainly wouldn't believe that happened. They would see animals and plants, evolving even to this present day through the whole period of time. But we have in Genesis, all the plants appear on the third day. And then on the fifth day, you've got animals in the sea and animals in the air, which would include not only fish and birds, but even the mammals that occupy those ecosystems. And that's, you don't see land animals until the sixth day. And And then, of course, you have the man appearing before the woman and all of that. So, I mean, you really can't squeeze evolution into that picture. So I think that those Christians who do believe in evolution do so by taking Genesis 1 in a figurative way. Now, there's different ways they try it. For example, some take it rather literally. Those who hold to the gap theory, which I think is very poorly documented. I don't think there's much basis for the gap theory, but there's many Christians, like the Scofield Reference Bible presented it, that in the first verse of Genesis 1, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And then verse 2 says, "The earth was," or they say could be translated, "The earth became formless and void." Now, they say between those two statements, there could be a very long period of time, billions of years even. They say that God created the heavens and the earth maybe billions of years ago. And then there's an unmentioned period of time that could be billions of years long. And then sometime much more recently, the world became formless and void as per verse 2. And then you have actually seven literal days of creation, perhaps, following this, billions of years gap. They usually use that in order to justify certain things like the alleged billions of years age of the earth. Sometimes they place the dinosaurs in that gap. Sometimes they even place the fall of Satan in that gap, and even a pre-Adamic human race rebelling against God during that time. All very speculative, of course, since there's not a word in Scripture that suggests that there is a gap there. In fact, there's a strong word in Scripture that suggests there isn't one, because in Exodus 20 in verse 11, God, when he was giving the Ten Commandments, and particularly the command about the Sabbath, he said, "In 6 days, the Lord created the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them." Now, notice what God himself, by his own statement to Moses, what he includes within the 6 day period, the creation of the heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them. That means that the 6 days of creation include everything. There's not a gap between the creation of the heaven and earth, for example, and the creation of everything that's in it. So the gap theory seems to be flawed biblically, and it seems to be only an expedient that some people have adopted in order to try to accommodate the alleged very ancient age of rocks and so forth, and of the planets and the universe. It was a valiant attempt, but I don't think it's a good one. Then, of course, you've got people with the day-age theory. Now, these ones are taking Genesis 1 a little less literally. They say, well, it wasn't literal days. A morning and an evening only means the beginning and ending of an age. It's a figurative way of speaking about an age. Each day is an age, maybe millions of years long. And so that the evolution was taking place in this way. When it says that in that day God created these things, well, if that day was millions of years long, then God could have created it through an evolutionary process. And
would all the days overlap in that case?
Well, that's the problem. That's the problem, because even if you want to extend those days to millions of years, you don't have the proper order for the appearance of the different species as evolution would want to find it, you know. So, I mean, Genesis 1 would still contradict the theory of evolution if you make the days millions of years long. So there's another view that's sometimes held. It's called the framework theory. And it's saying that basically Genesis 1 is just a poem, or if not a poem, at least it's a stylized literary piece that is simply affirming that God made everything, but it's not really telling us how or in what order or whatever. It's more that the structure of it is more based on a literary concern than on historical information. And these people often would believe the earth is billions of years old and evolution took place and all of that. But they say that we don't need to harmonize it with Genesis 1, because Genesis 1 is not trying to give us anything like the historical description, but rather something more like a literary, even perhaps a poetic kind of a description, which isn't describing the creation of heaven and earth, but only affirming it, only affirming that God is the creator. And what they would point out is that in the first 3 days, this is how they put it, God created he created these spheres of existence on the first 3 days, and then he filled those spheres on the second 3 days. So on the in the first series, you've got the first day, God creates the heavens and the earth, and he creates light. And so you have him then on the fourth day filling the heavens with the heavenly bodies, the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day, which is simply seen as a literary parallel to the first day. They're seen two sets of three, and they set them in two columns. The first one stands against the fourth, the second against the fifth, and the third one against the sixth, you see. And so on the first day, he creates the heavens and the earth and light, and on the fourth, it mentions his creating the sun and the moon and the stars, which occupy those heavens and carry that light. Then in the second day, he creates the seas, basically, the waters above and the waters below, the firmament. And so we've got the sky and the sea, whereas on the fifth day, when the animals in the sky and the sea are created, it's simply corresponding to that. It's not really giving us a true order of things. It's more of a literary correspondence. And then the dry land appears on the third day, and corresponding to that would be the sixth day, where the land, animals, and man were created. So people who take it's called the framework theory. They're saying that the Genesis 1 is not really giving us, or not even attempting to give us, not even pretending to give us a historical narrative of how things were done, but rather it's giving us the affirmation that God created the heavens, the earth, and the sea and the sky, and the land, and he also filled it with the things that are in it, and that it's doing it in a way that's structured as a framework that's more, like I say, more literary than historical in its concerns. Now, I don't hold any of those views. I personally think that the evidence favors taking Genesis 1 as a historical narrative. I tend toward a young earth creation. I would say, though, that we do have to give place when it becomes necessary to true findings of science. That is to say, if science could truly prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Darwinian evolution accounted for the rise of all species, if they could prove beyond a shadow of doubt that the heavens are as billions of years old as they say, if that evidence was unambiguous and certain, then we would be compelled as Christians to take something like a framework theory or something less than a literal approach to Genesis 1, because we have to truly not be ostriches with our heads in the sand. I mean, what science proves, if it's really proven, we're not going to reject it. For example, before the Earth was proven to be round, there were some people, and still are some people, who felt that the Bible describes a flat Earth. Well, I don't think the Bible describes a flat Earth, but one of the reasons I don't is because I know from scientific discovery that the Earth is round, and therefore I recognize certain things in the Bible as figurative when it talks about the four corners of the Earth, for example. That is, our knowledge from science being absolutely certain that the Earth is round helps us to recognize things in the Bible that are not literal, which would be perhaps people would have the liberty to take literally before science proved otherwise. And I think the same thing is true here. I don't think science is going to prove that evolution on a grand scale occurred because, frankly, they've been trying awfully hard, and the evidence that they need most, transitional forms, is simply stubbornly refusing to turn up. And I don't think it's going to. But if it did, I don't even know how they could prove it beyond a shadow of doubt, but if there was, if it was proven to be true, just like the roundness of the Earth has now been proven to be true beyond a shadow of a doubt, then we would probably have to, and I think, you know, with maybe some humble pie that we eat with it because we've been saying otherwise, but nonetheless, if we're lovers of truth, we would go with the view that, well, Genesis 1 must be God's way of saying something without telling us the exact way he did it. But until such happens, I'm able to take Genesis 1 literally, and that's what my default is. Now, if people think I do have my head in the sand, I will say I don't know everything. I don't know all the evidence the scientists are using, but I've, over the years, sought to read up on, you know, the main arguments for evolution and for the ancient age of the universe, and I've tried to read up on the evidence is against it, and to my mind, it's ambiguous. I don't think that there is absolute proof for evolution by any means. I think there's strong evidence that the theory is flawed. And for that reason, I don't feel that I'm compelled at this point to reach, counterintuitive interpretations of Genesis 1.
have been mostly studying old Earth, old universe arguments by by non-Christians.
Oh, yeah. Well, what about Hugh Ross? He's a Christian, and he takes those views, right?
Yeah, I don't know about him. I've just been looking online of what I can find. People, mostly what I found were non-Christians and just the scientific arguments that they give for that. And I guess there are some arguments made, and the evidence for that can also be ambiguous of whether it really does even support an old Earth itself, whether it's, you know, a problem for both theories.
Well, we have to, here's the thing, you know, when people say, well, it's been proven that the Earth is very old by such and such evidences, or that evolution accounts for the origin of life by whatever processes, what they mean by saying it's proven is that the scientists who began with the assumption that it cannot be supernatural have found no way of escaping the conclusions that they reach. You know, that is, they reach their evolutionary and uniformitarian conclusions and so forth as simply the only possible option for them, because they're ruling out at the outset supernaturalism. We find the same thing to be true in other fields where the Bible seems to speak. I mean, certainly there's a lot of things in the Bible that depict things like demon possession, but a naturalistic researcher looking at a patient who's demon-possessed would never be able to say that's what it is, because they don't believe in demons, so they have to resort to something else. They have to come up with a label and an explanation that's naturalistic. Whether it's a good description or not, it's the best they can do, because they are determined to exclude the supernatural from the outset.
Yeah, I've heard of people trying to come up with naturalistic explanations for Jesus walking on water and a virgin birth and all sorts of crazy miracles like that. That really shouldn't need no natural explanation. But I think that answered my question, mainly the point of the framework theory, I guess, was the main piece of information that I was missing in that question. So I appreciate that, and I'll let you get on to your other callers. So,
Well, Adam, thanks for calling. Actually, there aren't other calls right now. They've been so fascinated by your question that they have been mesmerized, and they haven't dialed their phones.
Okay. Well, I don't really have anything else to say, so...
All right. Well, I've got plenty of questions written in, and we'll be getting calls in a moment, because I just announced we don't have callers. All right. Well, God bless you.
All right. God bless you. Talk to you later.
Good talking to you. Okay. You too. Bye now. All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you would like to occupy our presently empty switchboards, you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. 90. I have an accumulation of questions that have been written into me by people over the last few weeks, which I never get to on the air unless there's not calls. And there's not very often that we don't have calls. So this is a good time for me to take a question from Liz, who wrote. She says, I grew up in the United Pentecostal / Apostolic Church and have been raised to believe that we must maintain certain physical standards. Funny thing is, most of the standards in our church apply towards women. We are not supposed to wear pants, short sleeves, makeup, or jewelry because it is considered a sin, vain, immodest, and or an abomination. They always say it is wrong for a woman to wear pants because they refer to the scripture in Deuteronomy 22:5, which says it's an abomination for a woman to wear what pertains to a man and for a man to wear what pertains to a woman. And as for makeup, they say it is a sin because the prostitutes wore it, and the jewelry is said to be a sin because it's considered vain. I attend a different church now with a similar oneness of God foundation, but the standards are different. The women wear pants, makeup, and jewelry and maintain a modest look, nothing over the top. I can't help but feel like I am doing something wrong if I wear jeans or a wedding band, and I think that it is a result of my upbringing and my being conditioned that all people who believe in not following these standards will burn in hell, as they teach. I can't believe that the Lord would allow so many people who love Him and praise Him would go to hell due to the standards that the United Pentecostal Church has maybe taken out of context or interpreted in a different way. What are your thoughts on this? Signed, Liz. Well, it's not just the United Pentecostal Church. There are a number of holiness-type churches. Of course, the United Pentecostal is a oneness Pentecostal church, and believe in the oneness doctrine rather than in the Trinity, but that's a separate issue. You're talking more about their cultural standards rather than their theological issues. And now you're in another church with the same theology, but a looser cultural standard. I think the standards that you were raised with that were very strict reflect, for the most part, an earlier cultural sensitivity that you don't find very often in churches anymore. And I don't agree with those strict standards. I don't believe that it's a sin to wear makeup or jewelry or for a woman to wear pants. The matter of women wearing pants is an interesting case because at one time, of course, the styles in North America and the Western world were that men wore pants and women wore dresses, and that was that. Sometime in the 20th century, women began to sometimes wear pants. There was a brief time in the 90s where men started wearing dresses once in a while, some of the stranger men, but they were trying to set a style. I don't know if that caught on. I don't know that I ever see men wearing dresses now. But sometime back in the early 1900s, it became a style for women also to wear pants, which had been previously considered a man's clothing. But now, of course, we live in a culture where pants are not considered a man's clothing. Now, it says in Deuteronomy, a woman should not wear what pertains to a man. But it does not tell us what kind of clothing pertains to a man. In the days Deuteronomy was written, the men were wearing, you know, togas and robes, and women were wearing robes of a different coloring and so forth. But for the most part, none of them were wearing what we call pants. And so the Bible does not say that pants are a man's style. And nor does it say that a dress or a skirt is a woman's style. It is cultural. If you go to Scotland and men are wearing kilts, which look like skirts to us, they don't feel like they're wearing something that pertains to a woman, although similar styles are not common in America. And likewise, 200 years ago, though, you know, if a woman wore pants, she would be considered to be deliberately trying to dress like a man. But today, when a woman wears pants, she's not thinking in those terms because pants are not distinctly a style that refers to masculinity. In fact, there are styles of pants that no man would be caught dead wearing unless he was effeminate. Because, I mean, there are some pants that are strictly female in style. So it's kind of an absurdity to say that pants as a category are a men's clothing item. That may have been true at one time, but what clothing items are considered to be suitable for male or female are cultural questions that are not absolute, and they change over time and from place to place. Therefore, since the styles have changed, it is obviously not possible to say that pants are a style that are male or masculine. There's plenty of acceptance. I mean, there's essentially universal acceptance of women wearing pants, and therefore a Christian woman who puts on pants is not putting on something that in our culture pertains to a man and is therefore not violating Deuteronomy 22:5. As far as makeup and jewelry and so forth goes, well, I mean, I believe that all Christians should be concerned about modesty, but the Bible does not tell us that it's immodest to wear jewelry or makeup. It is apparently true, I don't know this to be absolutely true, but it is apparently true that makeup originally was something that was worn by prostitutes and that ordinary women didn't wear it. And but that's, again, not the case now. That's not the case now. Lots of women wear makeup who are very moral and modest people. And the same thing is true of jewelry. So really, I personally think that when people are choosing their clothing and the way they groom themselves and so forth, they should be thinking about those subjects the same way we're told to think about everything. We're told whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. And I think that a man or a woman in choosing clothing styles no longer has to ask if pants are a men's style or a woman's style. That's not an issue anymore. But in choosing what kind of clothes to wear, a person should, if they're a Christian, think, do these clothes glorify God? And an aspect of that is, how will these clothes advertise my convictions? How will these clothes affect the people who look at me? I do think that there can be an insensitivity on women's parts to the way that men react to a woman's shape. And I have been in churches where women, they could be wearing pants or dresses. Actually, some of the dresses are less modest than pants. I don't see that it's a matter of pants or dress. I think it's a matter of, is a person wearing clothing that is designed and has the purpose of calling attention to a person's sexual distinctives? That is, a woman's shape, her breasts, or whatever. Or a man wearing pants that are really tight that, you know, that reveal things that don't need to be revealed publicly. That kind of thing, those things are designed for the purpose of arousing sexual interest in onlookers. A lot of times women are less aware than they should be of how such visual stimuli affect men, even good men, who are trying to keep their eyes off of them. When you're standing in church or someplace and a woman is right in front of you and the way she's dressed is calling attention to her shape in a dramatic way, that's not healthy for a man. He doesn't like that if he's a godly man. If he's not a godly man, he may love it, but for the wrong reasons. So, I mean, a person needs to consider not, should I wear pants or not? The question is, are the clothes I'm wearing calculated to draw the wrong kind of attention to myself? And we do need to remember that whether a woman's makeup or jewelry or her clothing or a man's clothing and hairstyles and those kinds of things, they're all sending a message. Basically, just like when you wear a T-shirt that's got an advertisement on the front, you know that your clothes are advertising a product. But even without the advertisement, a distinctive style of clothing sends a message, too. And Christians need to make sure that the message that their image is communicating is one that's appropriate to what they really want to be communicating to the world. But the matter of makeup and jewelry and stuff, I honestly don't think that in itself is an issue. It would have a lot more to do with why is one doing it. See, God looks at the heart. Why does a woman want to wear makeup? Why does a woman want to wear jewelry? Why does she want to dress a certain way? Those are the things a woman should be asking herself, because that's what God's looking at. God's not looking at the styles. He's looking at other issues related to the styles. Why do you choose this style? What do you hope to communicate to others by dressing this way? What impact is it having in terms of tempting and so forth other people that you dress a certain way? Those are the questions that a Christian needs to ask. And I don't think that Christianity should impose specific dress codes. Just there are spiritual principles. In all of our outward behavior that's public, there are spiritual principles that should be observed. And the main one being, love your neighbors, you love yourself. And if you're around Christian people who are trying to avoid being tempted, and you wear clothing that aggravates the temptation, then that's not very loving. And I would suggest that that's the main thing a woman should be considering when concerned those particular issues. Let's talk to Neil, who's calling from Portland, Oregon. We also have a line open for you, and that line can be accessed at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Neil, thanks for waiting, and welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes, thank you, Steve. This is just a scheduling situation that I want to know about. I've heard you mention you're coming here and that you're coming to McMinnville, but I'm wondering if you're going to be doing Portland or Camas on this trip.
I am. I will be. I'll be in McMinnville on Friday the 12th. I'll be in Camas Saturday night the 13th, and I'm preaching in Camas in the same location on Sunday morning.
And is that the same church where you've been in Camas before?
Yes, it is. So if you've been there before, it's the Calvary Community Church in Camas.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's where we have the Saturday night and the Sunday morning.
Great, great. Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
Oh, okay, great. And that should be at our website before long if it's not there yet.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Yeah, I guess I could make that clear. I'll be speaking on Friday night, the 12th of this month, so it's a week from Friday, in McMinnville, Oregon. And that's in the Portland area. It's about an hour drive from Portland. That's at 7 o'clock, and that's held at the First Mennonite Church in McMinnville. It is not a meeting of that church. In fact, they haven't. It's not like that church invited me. I rent their church. I've been renting that church for such meetings for years. And they're very generous and give us a good rate for it, so it's affordable for me to do that. And we just have meetings there for our listeners to come, and I'm going to be teaching. Actually, I think I'm going to be teaching on intelligent design on Friday night, the 12th, in McMinnville. And so if you have friends who don't believe in intelligent design, feel free to bring them along. I'll have a PowerPoint presentation with that, too, which I usually don't. Then on Saturday night, February 13th, I'll be at Camas, Washington, in the normal place. This is where we've been going a lot of times when I come up there. That's an open Bible discussion. It's held in a church because it got too large to hold in a home. And it's held in the Calvary Community Church in Camas. And then for the first time ever, I'll be preaching at the Camas Community Church on Sunday morning. Two services, one at 9, one at 11 Sunday mornings. So there's, like I said, there's either information now or will be soon at our website about those locations. Now, we still, let's see here, we still have a line open if you'd like to call. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Pearl from Salinas, California. Pearl, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. I'll take the answer off the air. My question is about Melchizedek. In the Old Testament, was he really a high priest, or was he Jesus?
Well, okay, you say you want to take that off the air?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll be glad to address that question.
Okay, I know he was a precursor to Abraham.
Well, he was contemporary with Abraham.
Oh, okay, well, this is going to be great. Then let me hang up.
Okay, Pearl.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for your call. Okay, well, yeah, there was some noise on that line, so it's probably better to be hung up while I try to answer your question. Melchizedek is mentioned in only three places in the Bible. And the first is when he met Abraham in Genesis 14, when Abraham had gone in a battle to rescue his nephew from being taken as a prisoner of war. And Abraham was successful in liberating the prisoners and taking his son, his nephew Lot, back to safety. And on his way back from the battle, he was met by a man who is just mentioned kind of out of nowhere. It said he was met by a man named Melchizedek, who we are told was the king of Salem and the priest of the Most High God. And this man gave a blessing to Abraham, and Abraham gave 10% of the spoils to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek brought out bread and wine and nourished and refreshed the troops, I guess. And that's all we hear about him. There's no explanation of this man except that he's the king of Salem and priest of the Most High God. Well, one of the problems, even with that, is that priest of the Most High God, well, what does a priest do? A priest officiates at an altar. That's what priests do. They offer sacrifices on behalf of people. That's what a priest is. And yet, God had not established any religious altar anywhere. God had not established a religion and a priesthood in Abraham's time. It wasn't until hundreds of years later, in Moses' time, that God established the tabernacle and the altar and the priesthood and all of that. So here we have Melchizedek hundreds of years before there were any priests in Israel. And he's apparently a priest of some kind, and he is a genuine priest, not a pagan priest. He's a priest of the Most High God. Another thing that makes that difficult is that Salem is the name that almost all scholars take to be a short form of the word Jerusalem. It actually is the same as the Hebrew word Shalom, meaning peace. But Salem, or Yerushalom, is the name for Jerusalem. But in the days of Abraham, Jerusalem was a pagan Canaanite city. It later became an Israeli city in the days of David, 1,000 years later than this. But in Abraham's days, Salem or Jerusalem was a pagan town. And how could the king of a pagan town, a Canaanite town, be also the priest of the Most High God. It's very mysterious. And yet we're not given any explanation of those things. It's just told in a very matter-of-fact way. Now, the Jewish traditions are that Melchizedek was Shem, one of the youngest son of Noah. And that this Shem actually, when we read of Shem's lifetime, he would still be alive at this time. Shem would probably at that time be the oldest living man, because the flood had wiped out the entire human population except for Noah and his sons. Noah was dead by this time, and it's possible that Shem's older brothers were dead by this time. And Shem himself, a very ancient man, he could have been the most senior human being on the planet. And Shem was presumably a godly man. So this, the Jewish rabbis have come up with the thought that maybe this was Shem. Although we have no way to know that Shem ever became the king of Jerusalem or the priest of the Most High God, and we certainly don't know why he would be called Melchizedek instead of Shem. Well, in the same book, Genesis, which calls him Shem, now calls this man Melchizedek. Why wouldn't he mention him as Shem? There are some difficulties in identifying this as Shem, although it seems to be, a pretty respectable view among the Jewish rabbis. But he is only mentioned there in Genesis 14. He's never mentioned again in the Old Testament until 1,000 years later when David writes about him. And only a single verse. In Psalm 110, verse 4, David, speaking prophetically to the Messiah, says, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now, this is a bizarre statement for David to make, because David lived under the Jewish order. There were priests. There was a tabernacle. There was, the Aaronic priesthood. They were not of the order of Melchizedek. They were not even related to Melchizedek. They were their very priestly office was determined by their inheritance from their ancestor Aaron. So there was the order of Aaron, the Levitical priesthood, not the order of Melchizedek. And yet, though that the priesthood of Aaron is the only priesthood David ever knew of, he apparently had a revelation from God that the Messiah would be of a different order, and that order would be the order of Melchizedek. And that must have seemed very strange to David and his contemporaries to make that statement, because Melchizedek was an obscure character in Genesis who had lived 1,000 years earlier and had gone unmentioned in the intervening period. And David just says, by inspiration, that the Messiah is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Well, that's all that we have in the Old Testament. Strange stuff. And then there's one chapter in the New Testament that expounds on those things. And that's, of course, Hebrews chapter 7. I can't go into it in detail because the time constraints wouldn't allow it. We have other calls to take. But chapter 7 of Hebrews goes into this and takes everything we know about Melchizedek from the Old Testament and tries to give sort of his own points on it. He first says, okay, what do we know about this man Melchizedek? We know his name. His name Melchizedek means, if you translate the word Melchizedek, it means king of righteousness. Okay, so the writer of Hebrews makes that point in verse 2. He says, first, he's being translated the king of righteousness. And he says, and then also he's the king of Salem, meaning the king of peace. That is, the writer of Hebrews does not take Salem to be a reference to the city of Jerusalem, but he takes it as simply what the word itself means, shalom. Salem means shalom, it's peace. So he says, just knowing this, if we only know that he's Melchizedek, king of Salem, we can deduce that he's the king of righteousness and the king of peace. Now we're on to something. And then it says he was the priest of the Most High God. Well, okay, we'll save some of that for later. But then in verse 3, Hebrews 7:3 says he's without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. Now, the man had no father or mother or genealogy. Now, there's two views that Christians hold on Melchizedek. Some believe that he is Christ, as what we call a theophany in the Old Testament, and others believe he is just a man, an ordinary man, who is a type of Christ. But if he is an ordinary man, how could he be without father, without mother? Well, those who take that view say, well, all that the writer of Hebrews is suggesting is that we don't have record of his father and mother. He's a man whose priesthood is not based on a recorded genealogy. But that's not true. It says he has no beginning of days or end of life. And it says that he remains a high priest continually based on the fact that he has no end of life. We're talking about Melchizedek here. It says he's been made like Jesus. Jesus is the incarnate Son of God. And he's been made like the Son of God in that he, Melchizedek, remains, present tense, a priest continually. So the writer of Hebrews was saying not only was Melchizedek a priest in the days of Abraham, 2,000 years before the time of Hebrews, but he remained a priest even into the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews. At the time the writer was writing, he says, this man, Melchizedek, remains a priest even to this day. So we've got a man we're dealing with who's been a priest for 2,000 years by the time this is written. And obviously we're not talking about an ordinary man. Therefore, it says he had no father, mother, beginning of life or end of days. Clearly, he means that literally. That's the only way he could remain a priest to this day. And then he says in verse 4, consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils. Now, we don't have to go any further than this to know that Melchizedek is Jesus. Because the writer of Hebrews, throughout the whole book, is arguing that Jesus is greater than everybody. And in the earlier chapters, he points out Jesus is greater than the angels. Jesus is greater than Moses. He's greater than Aaron. He's greater than Joshua. He's greater than everybody who's a hero in the Old Testament. But then, what's he going to change course and say, now let's talk about Melchizedek, what a great man he was. That's totally meaningless, unless Melchizedek was Jesus. The purpose of the writer of Hebrews is only to point out how great Jesus is, not how great Old Testament characters are. His point is how comparatively ungreat the Old Testament characters are compared to Jesus. And now what, he's going to go off on a tangent and talk about how great a man is who isn't Jesus? I don't think so. He's saying that Melchizedek was like the incarnate Christ. He was a manifestation of the second person of the Trinity in human form. And that's why we can talk about how great he was, because Jesus is of his order. And, you know, he later says that in verse 24, Melchizedek has an unchangeable or a non-transferable priesthood, unlike the Aaronic priesthood. Now, let me just give you what he says there. It says in the Aaronic priesthood, verse 23 says, there were many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing. That is, the Aaronic priests had to be replaced each generation by the death of the predecessor. But he makes a contrast between them and Melchizedek, who apparently was never replaced because he didn't die, unlike the Aaronic priest. But he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable or a non-transferable priesthood. Now, we're told here that the Melchizedek priesthood is non-transferable, unlike the Aaronic priesthood. Aaron passed on his priesthood to his sons, and they passed on to their sons. But Melchizedek didn't pass down his priesthood. It's unchangeable. But Jesus has it. How could two different men at different times have the same priesthood if it's not transferable, unless they're the same man? Well, that's what I think. I think we're talking about Jesus in a pre-incarnate appearance when we talk about Melchizedek. I think that's what the writer of Hebrews is trying to get across. He also says it here in verse 8. He says here, he means in the Aaronic priesthood, the Old Testament priesthood, says here mortal men receive tithes. That is, the priests of the Aaronic priesthood are mortal men. Here, mortal men receive tithes, but there, meaning when Abraham gave tithes to Melchizedek, he received them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. In other words, the one who received tithes from Abraham, Melchizedek, was not a mortal man. He's in contrast with mortal men. And it is testified that he lives, present tense. Well, in what sense has it ever been testified that Melchizedek lives? I think the writer of Hebrews is referring to the fact that Christians continually testify Jesus lives. And he's saying, well, that's Melchizedek. So it is testified that Melchizedek lives. Unlike the Aaronic priests who have died, Melchizedek doesn't die. So there's some kind of interesting stuff here, but I don't have time to go into it in more detail. I'm sure there are lectures on my website about Melchizedek if you go to Hebrews 7 under the topic, the verse-by-verse teaching. We need to talk to one other caller before we run out of time. That's going to be Larry from Sterling. Is that Sterling, Virginia?
Yep, Sterling, Virginia.
Ah, welcome.
Hi, Steve. This is my first time calling, so I appreciate your ministry and the way you approach being thorough in explaining all the different perspectives and views on Scripture. I know you don't have a lot of time, but let me just get to my question. Have you ever taught on anything or have any perspective on the nature of Adam and Eve before sin? In other words, I've heard it said before that they were sort of clothed with light or in some kind of a different state than it, apparently they were after sin. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, I've never taught on it because we're not given specific information in the Bible about it. But I've certainly heard that from my childhood, that when the Bible says they were naked and they were not ashamed, and then after they fell, they put on clothing because they saw that they were naked. Some people think that the reason they didn't know they were naked before was because they were not fully visible to each other. There was sort of a radiance or a light, almost a blinding radiance, apparently, that kept them from being able to observe each other's nakedness. Now, they may have been radiant, but I don't think that that's why they didn't know they were naked. I think the reason they didn't know they were naked earlier is because they had no reason to be sensitized to it. Like a little child running around naked doesn't know he's naked either. He's not aware of any reason not to be naked. But when they sinned, they felt guilty, and they felt, like most people, shame, and they wanted to hide. And being naked, they felt exposed and so forth, just like a child who reaches some age where they don't want to be seen naked anymore. They just become aware that that just seems inappropriate and it's embarrassing. So I don't think we have to assume that they were clothed in some kind of light before they sinned, and that is why they didn't know they were naked. But it is possible that they did exhibit some kind of radiance. They were made in the image of God. My suspicion is that their bodies before the fall probably are to be like the ones that we will have after the resurrection. When we're glorified, Paul said that this mortality will put on immortality. And this, you know, we're sown in weakness, but we're raised in strength. And we're sown in dishonor, but we're raised in glory. Sown means buried, dead. When we're dead, we're buried in dishonor, but we'll rise from the dead in glory and in strength and in immortality. And my thought is that the whole purpose of the resurrection is to restore the redeemed race to the condition it was before the fall. And when God made the Garden of Eden and made Adam and Eve originally, he made them the way that they potentially could have lived forever if they had never fallen. So it must have been the way he would have liked them to be forever. And the fall has kind of interrupted that. And my impression is that the redemption that Christ has accomplished and the resurrection that we look forward to will recover all that was lost of the original plan. So my thought is that their bodies were probably a lot like ours will be in the resurrection. But even that is not given much description in the Bible.
Yeah. Well, you know, in 1 Corinthians 15, it always troubled me when Paul is making a contrast between, and he's talking about the resurrection and glorification, but he's making a contrast between Christ and Adam, and it sort of gives a description as though that Adam, even, and he was created in, you know, either perfect state or unsinful state, that he was still simply a man of the earth.
Yeah.
That has an earthly body just like us. And that the whole glorification of the saints comes about as a result of Christ coming from heaven, becoming a man, and then going through the whole redemptive process, and then being resurrected, glorified. So it appears as though the point that he's making is that Adam was just as normal as we are, so to speak.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, that's a good point. Yeah, I think the idea that he was clothed in some kind of supernatural light may be mistaken. And I might even be mistaken in thinking that he was given an immortal body. It does seem possibly that his immortality was conditional on him eating the tree of life. Something we could discuss in more detail another time. I don't wish to cut you off, but I'm going to be cut off myself, so I'm going to have to wind this out.
Okay, I'll call back another time. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless you, Larry. Thanks
right,
for calling.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're a listener-supported ministry. If you want to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Now, I'm speaking at Twin Lakes Church in Aptos tonight. Information about that can be found at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. You'd want to go to the announcements link, thenarrowpath.com. Talk to you again tomorrow. God bless.